So thanks again for having me here as a visitor for a few months. And I'm going to tell you about some work that's been actually ongoing over a number of years. The original paper, which Neil might actually remember, I was going to tell him, we were both postdocs at Santa Barbara in that paper. Anyway, there are two parts to the talk, and we'll see how far I get, as usual, depending on your questions. Please feel free to interrupt. So the motivation for all of this is, of course, dark energy and the cosmological constant issue, which has been ongoing for years. And I was working on thinking about in the 80s as a postdoc, actually. And the analogy I want to draw is to the electric field of a cosmological electric field, a field that could exist in all of space without any sources, and what goes on there. That's, of course, related to the Schwinger effect, and I'll try to draw this analogy. The main point I want to make in this segment is that you define what the appropriate boundary conditions are in and out vacuum states, and whether or not the field is stable to pair creation by the I epsilon prescription, not by Euclidean continuation. And so I'll draw this analogy with both the electric field and the Sitter cases. And then, depending on how much time we have, I'll outline the effective theory coming from the conformal anomaly, which basically allows one to study the evolution of the dark energy and the fact that there are additional scalar modes in this anomaly. And if, at the end, try to get to something observational, like non-Gaussianity and the gravitational, primordial gravitational wave spectrum. Okay, so let's start elementary term. This is, of course, a phrase that I termed. Most people don't think there is a cosmological electric field problem. But if you think about it this way, there could be. After all, if I have no sources in Maxwell's equations, I can have a solution in which an electric field is constant and uniform in space and time. And we don't observe such a field, right? The electric field could have an arbitrary value point in an arbitrary direction and could be very large in principle. If I were just doing electrodynamics, I might think the natural scale is the electron mass. But there is no such field. And why might very well be related to the quantum effects of pair creation. Because the vacuum, as Schwinger told us back in the 50s, is unstable to particle creation, and such a field cannot persist for long. So let's review that physics. So think of the universe as a huge capacitor in which you have some plates very distant somewhere out towards the horizon, let's say, which is creating an electric field. You can describe that in either a time-dependent gauge, like this, if it's pointing in the z direction, or in a time-independent gauge, which looks like this. Of course, you get the same results no matter how you look at it in whichever gauge. You just have to be careful of the boundary conditions. If you look at it in a time-dependent gauge, then you won't be surprised that there is particle creation because you have a time-dependent background, which is basically supplying energy into the system and create pairs. If you think about in a time-independent gauge, well, then the Hamiltonian is unbounded from below, and so because it's just a linear potential. So once again, one has to expect some sort of instability to creation of pairs. The vacuum, of course, has fluctuating pairs on a scale of Compton wavelength, and this instability is there even in free field theory. You don't need interactions to see it. Of course, what happens after the particles are created is going to depend on the interactions. And I have to remind everyone that really we give the credit to say Schwinger, but the original observation goes way back to Schuckelberg in this beautiful little paper written during the middle of World War II, in which he pointed out very clearly that in relativistic quantum mechanics, you can describe pair creation as simply a world line turning back on itself. That's pair annihilation, or coming up this way, this is a pair creation event. And it's very clearly written, hardly any equations. It's just the basic idea is that causality is enforced by the world line always going forward in its own internal proper time, no no matter what the coordinate time outside the outside universe is. Very nice thing, very beautiful idea. So the result of Schwinger's calculation, which you've probably all seen at some point, is this famous formula for the k rate of the vacuum into pairs, plus the minus sign here is for bosons or fermions. Notice it's non-perturbatively dependent on the electric field strength. And again, I'll just very briefly sketch how this works because it's relevant to what I want to say about the Sitter space. And this sum over n is basically labeling how many pairs you produce. So this is a rate for producing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pairs. And you get a very nice space-time picture of what's going on. Just harkening back to that Stueckelberg paper, you can think of the semicircle here as a tunneling event in imaginary time. Of course, an electric field continued to imaginary time looks like a magnetic field, and then the orbits are circular. Ah, you made it. Okay.
Great.
Eventually.
Okay. So this is what the tunneling event looks like in imaginary time. Basically, think of the particles as being separated, moving on classical circular, semicircular trajectories. Then at this slice, they appear, and you continue to real time, and now they move on hyperbolic trajectories being accelerated away. And this gives you a very nice picture of the creation event. And this sum over n can be understood as just in the Euclidean picture, how many times you wind around, which therefore means how many pairs you produce at the surface. And this factor here, this tunneling factor, is nothing else but the imaginary or Euclidean action for this world line path going around in the circle.
Can I ask, is this the case, continues however small the electric field is?
Yeah, it's exponentially small. It's exponentially small. It made the electric field to zero.
Even though the particle masses are finite, there's no
right
threshold that prevents the decay going all the way to zero.
Right. But it's exponentially suppressed.
Slowly.
Yeah, exceedingly slowly. Yeah, this is of course a spontaneous rate out of the vacuum. It presupposes that you had nothing there to begin with. Okay, so here's the formalism that Schwinger used. It's the heat kernel or world line time, proper time formalism, which basically just realizes in explicit calculations what Stueckelberg's idea was. So you basically have to write down the particle Hamiltonian in a fifth or proper time, which is called S. And you describe this heat kernel, which is essentially, it's called a heat kernel, of course, because it looks like a diffusion equation if there were no I. But there is an I because it's a Schrodinger-like unitary evolution. And it's important that this exponentiates with only S going forward in time. Okay, that's exactly the Stueckelberg prescription. And this can also be thought of as a path integral to go from point x to x prime. These are in four-dimensional coordinates. So this is a fifth time. This is not the coordinate time. It's the world line time or proportional to the world line time of the particle. And you can write this as a path integral. Here's the world line action. And this is just when I continue to imaginary time, that's the thing which gives me this exponential tunneling factor. If I want the Green's function, I have to basically take the inverse of h, which means I have to integrate over s this way. And notice that in order for this to be well defined, s has to have a slight negative imaginary part. That's what makes this integral well defined. That's how you impose the boundary conditions of causality. The one loop effect of action is related to the determinant, which is the exponential of the trace of the log, and the log is related to this integral of ds over s. So these are one slide, gives you a compact formalism for doing anything in a background field, which works equally well for electric fields or for De Sitter space. And again, the important point from all this is that the integrals require an I epsilon prescription in the S world line time. Again, the particles move only forward in their proper time. So Schwinger calculated this for us. Here's what it looks like. If you just solve the classical problem, there's a classical action, and then there's a prefactor, van Vleck determinant. The imaginary part is calculated by taking the in-out expectation value, squaring it, so that twice, this is minus twice the imaginary part. And so I have to take the effective action, multiply it by 2, and take the imaginary part. And the imaginary part then is the tricky thing to calculate because it involves some analytic continuation in this S parameter. Again, the imaginary part of m squared times S has to be less than 0. It's not Euclidean continuation. If I did this in Euclidean time, I wouldn't get anything. So the calculation, which is in Schwinger's paper, he doesn't draw you a picture, but I did. It's basically you start out integrating over the s-axis, the real axis, but you have this small imaginary part. And the integrand has poles on the negative imaginary axis. So you rotate the contour. You're allowed to do that because the integral converges. And now you get these half circle contributions from all of these poles. And if you just do your little complex analysis problem, you'll get exactly Schwinger's answer. So that's a lightning fast review of the Schwinger calculation, basically using this heat kernel, which he calculated.
There's no weak renormalization
subtraction. The renormalization occurs in the real part. The real part of the action is, of course, infinite and requires subtractions. But the imaginary part is finite. So you can calculate it directly. Now, I'll give you a different way of looking at it. A different way of looking at it is to work in the wave picture. And here's the electric field in the time-dependent gauge. And I write down the Klein-Gordon equation, say, for modes which in the Fourier space look like e to the I kx times some function of time. And if I look at the function of the mode equation that arises then, this is just looks like a time-dependent harmonic oscillator with this frequency. Okay, which if the field is in the z direction, looks like that. So introduce dimensionless variables. And this looks like, again, a Schrodinger equation, but in a potential which is negative definite, so it's over the barrier scattering. And notice also that in this rescaled time variable, the potential is symmetric under u goes to minus u. That's just reflecting the fact that the constant electric field is, in fact, time symmetric. So that's why it's a little bit tricky, because if you have a time-symmetric background, you can imagine having a time-symmetric state in that background, and therefore get no decay rate, because a decay rate necessarily means you're choosing one direction of time, and that all comes from my epsilon. So anyway, here's the picture. You have a parabolic barrier, incident wave coming in, partially transmitted, partially reflected, and the reflection is basically telling you about particle creation, because once it's moving backwards, it's interpreted as an antiparticle. And here's again some formulas. Basically, you have a mode function, a solution of this equation, which an exact solution to this equation, which is some parabolic cylinder function that behaves like a pure phase as time goes minus infinity. And so that's the in mode. And pure phase as time goes to plus infinity is the out mode, and they're not the same. See, it's just this I lambda changes. And so you can understand what's going on as the mixing between the in and out modes. It's that reflection and transmission coefficients. So there is a reflected wave, and the antiparticles moving backward in time, this is basically enforcing the I epsilon prescription in the language of the mode functions. Because this is a positive, this is called a positive frequency, which means if I put a small I epsilon, it decays in one side of the complex plane as opposed to the other. So the non-trivial scattering implies particle creation. You find some Bogoliubov transformation between the in and out modes just by looking up the properties of these special functions in your favorite handbook. And so there is a Bogoliubov coefficient of mixing. The reflected wave, which has this amplitude, that's this, in fact, in the terms of the physical variables, That means that you're creating a pair with a probability that's basically this ratio of coefficients.
Please know that.
Lambda was just this, it's just dimensionless transverse momentum, divided by E. Right. But just to rescale. Okay. But that's the thing that enters the Bolgubov coefficient. And so the out-in squared is the vacuum persistence amplitude. So this is the probability of creating a pair. This is the probability of not creating a pair. And then this is the probability of not creating a pair in any state. So I take the product and exponentiate it, comes the sum. The sum, of course, diverges because the integral over k involves k perp, which is fine, but involves also kz. And this Bolgubov coefficient doesn't depend on kz, right? It depends on lambda. Not on kz because kz just comes together with the time. So what that's telling you is that the integral is diverging like time. So of course, this also has caused confusion over the years, is that of course, if you really took this to infinity, this persistence would be zero because you're creating pairs all the time. And so the probability that you still end up in the vacuum at an infinite time is zero. So in order to get a meaningful rate, you have to divide out by the time you imagine keeping the field on. And kz is, of course, proportional to the time just because it enters in that combination, kz plus eet. Now, I'll show you a little bit more carefully how you can extract this factor really rigorously. But basically, by this heuristic argument for now, and this is how you get the time variable, the time duration. So I divide by it, and I get a finite integral over k perp. And if I just expand that logarithm, I get back Schwinger's formula. Okay? So that's, I've given you now quickly two different ways of getting the decay rate. One is Schwinger's original method by the heat kernel, and the other is this scattering Bolgubov method. What we also did at some point was look at what's happening in real time, and basically, you see, in this language, from Schwinger's language, you can't see what's happening in real time. You just get the total decay rate. Whereas in this language, you can see what's happening is that gradually, this mode, which is the in mode, is looking like a combination of in and out modes at late times. And you can just go to an adiabatic basis and basically see how the reflected wave is being generated by the scattering. So the way you do that is you look at an adiabatic frequency expansion, which is valid if the frequency is changing slowly, and you define a time-dependent adiabatic mode function, and you compare the basis of these mode functions to the exact basis. And then you get a time-dependent particle creation, which is this, and then you can see what happens as this particle creation, you can see what happens as a function of time. It starts out at zero because this mode function matches the exact one arbitrarily well in the infinite past. But at some time around u equals zero, because that's where you're scattering over the barrier, something happens. And this amplitude builds up, something changes, it oscillates for a while, and then it goes to its asymptotic value. And that asymptotic value is the Bolgubov coefficient. The important thing here is that the asymptotic value is independent of how you do this. Of course, if you expand this to different orders, you'll get different approximations to the particle number. That's the blue and green show. So you get a slightly different picture of what's going on. And of course, right around this region, you cannot really define particles. That's a semi-classical concept. And it doesn't really make sense as the particles are being created. So there is some necessary uncertainty in what's happening in here, but it doesn't matter. Those are just the transient wiggles. The asymptotic value is always the same if you match any order. Okay? So that gives you a picture of what's happening in real time from the wave equation. This can also be understood in terms of the adiabatic method. that this this frequency function, which appears here, of course, has no, it's strictly positive on the real-time axis, and that's why it's over the barrier. But on the other hand, if I go into the complex plane, then it has a zero point, it has a turning point, and I can understand what's going on as I pass closest to the turning point at u equals zero. So there's a turning point up in the complex plane, and as I go between them, that's where I get all, that's where the oscillations happen, and that's where the particles get created. Of course, it's happening at a different time for each mode, because it's always at u equals zero, but that's a different time for each kz. And so now you can see why that linear factor of time enters. Because if you start at some initial time, t naught, which is finite, only modes which start with a negative value of u, but later on have a positive value of u, actually go through this event. And so you get a linear window, if you wish, from the initial time to any finite time, only these modes with this values of kz contribute, and that's that. Completely justifies why you get the linear function of time, which we just before divided out. Okay. The last thing I want to mention here in the electric field case is that you can actually get this linear time dependence also from in 2D directly from the anomaly, the chiral anomaly, by the bosonization formulas. The current is dual to the chiral current. The chiral current is a pure gradient. The chiral current has a anomalous divergence in 2D. And so if I put here a source, which is non-zero, I have to have a non-zero value of pi in order to satisfy this equation, which grows quadratically in time. And therefore, linearly, if I take one derivative, and that's telling me what the growth of the current is going to be. So you can get this result pretty quickly from the anomaly, just in 2D anyway. And then you have to think a little bit about how to apply it in 4D. But the point is that the anomalous divergence of the chiral current is actually relevant to this rate, which you could know or not know. If you don't know, you do it more directly. And we actually showed that if you start from an initial state at time zero and just calculate the expectation value, the normalized of the current, it does grow with time, and this coefficient is indeed given by the anomaly. So what does that tell you? Well, linear, if it's going to grow linearly in time, then no matter how small the field is or how small the coupling, eventually you're going to have to do back reaction, because that's going to react back on the electric field from Maxwell's equations. You can't escape. So notice these steps are all very simple, but it leads to something quite interesting, because you have a non-perturbative effect which leads to secular terms and leads to back reaction no matter how small the coupling or background field is. Something has to change at late times. We also looked at what happens if you do a mean field approximation. The current does build up linearly, but then it start sloshing back and forth in the large end approximation and actually solve this. Right? It starts to decay but doesn't go all the way down to zero, because this approximation, there are no direct interactions between the particles.
What's the N?
N?
Yeah.
Just an arbitrary replication of the number of fields and flavors. Okay.
And flavors of.
Yeah,
to
justify using the mean field approximation. So of course, this is not the exact formula. It's only a leading order mean field formula. So there will be corrections, and those corrections are important also at late times. So what does happen in electric fields? We think we know. You know, it's never been solved all the way in QED, but we think we know enough about electrodynamics that what's going to happen is particles are created. They radiate as they are accelerated in the field. That pumps more energy into the particle modes, so they can induce a pair creation process, and you get a cascade. So the mean field approximation is not going to describe this adequately. You're going to have to do something much more sophisticated. And what people actually do in other fields in plasma physics is, you know, they don't try to do this from first principles. They simply jump to a Boltzmann-like description and say, I have some particle density, and I describe this as a irreversible process of shorting out the field. So the way you do it is you basically introduce a irreversible conductivity tensor. So the current in Ohm's law is proportional to the maximum velocity that the particles reach before they collide with each other. So that's given in terms of some mean-free path, which you can estimate in terms of Thomson scattering, right, this problem. And or you can do this finite temperature. In any case, you get then finally an effective theory in which the electric field is damped out by the conductivity tensor and therefore relaxes to zero, and the cosmological electric field problem is solved. Okay. But there are a lot of steps here. And in order to do anything like this for gravity, we're only at the very start. Okay, so let's switch to De Sitter's. Unless you have questions about this.
So, you went very fast.
I did go very fast.
Just something about the conductivity. You have this cascade, you have to create that screen is the original one. How do you get to the, how do you compute the conductivity?
How do you compute conductivity? You have to, it's a response function of the currents in the background.
Yeah. So the
current
induced pair production.
Well, it's proportional to the basically the density of particles you create.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we don't know how to do this really in a non-equilibrium situation, that's the Boltzmann equation. But if you try to estimate things for the conductivity tensor at finite temperature, you know what the thermal distribution of particles is, and then you can actually calculate it and find how this goes to zero in it. If I put an electric field on a thermal plasma, typically people do non-relativistic plasma physics, but if we're interested in QED, you need to do it relativistically. So these are estimates. These are not first principles calculation.
Yeah, you need a plasma.
You need to produce a lot of particles, which then interact. Yeah, and you need the mean free path,
yeah,
how they collide with each other. So there's a lot of physics that has to be put in there in order to actually finally get the thing to relax. All right, now I want to go back to the beginning and just give you another little toy or false conundrum, which is, remember, I showed you that the electric field is symmetric in time, right? That's just under time reversal, it's even. And that shows up in that the potential is even under u goes to minus u. So it's a little exercise. You can actually create a state, go back here to this scattering problem, and artificially make a state in which it's completely symmetric in time in u. So I add the time reverse of this in such a way that particles are also coming in from that side and being reflected and created the other way. Okay, and if I do that, everything's time reversal invariant. There can't possibly be a decay rate. But it's, of course, a very strange state in which what I'm basically doing is every time a pair is being created, I'm sending in another pair from infinity to cancel the current. So by time symmetry, this state has exactly zero decay rate. So that looks like a consistent solution, right? There's no particle-antiparticle pairs are annihilated at the same rate as they're created. So nothing happens. No decay rate, looks stable. So was Schwinger wrong? Well, no, because this is not a zero-particle vacuum state. I've artificially arranged things to come in from infinity to cancel these things, and I'm not using the I epsilon prescription there, because I'm basically taking a sum of I epsilon and minus I epsilon. And that's indeed what I would get if I did this from Euclidean continuation, because in the Euclidean Euclideanization of an electric field is a magnetic field. Magnetic field particles move in circular orbits. They don't decay. Nothing happens. They just move around. The decay rate is zero. If I calculated everything in that Euclidean and then continued back, I'd get no decay rate and nothing happening. And that would be the wrong answer. But that is, in effect, what people are doing most of the time in gravity, because they're basically using the maximally symmetric state in De Sitter space to define a time-invariant background in which nothing apparently happens. And you have to be very careful. You have to look into that state and see what's really going on. And the other lesson here is that anomalies are relevant, and it really, we'll come back to this at the end, one has to do something pretty non-perturbative and non-trivial in order to really understand the relaxation. So let's go to De Sitter space. Fine. So De Sitter space, as you all know, is the maximally symmetric homogeneous space of positive cosmological constant with constant curvature everywhere. And I can think of it as a single-sheeted hyperboloid of revolution embedded in a five-dimensional space. Okay, so the symmetry group would be O5. This would be a four-sphere if I didn't have this time-like part. But it's actually the non-compact group, O41. But it has the same number of generators, maximal symmetry, as Minkowski space, three translations, rotations, four Lorentz boosts, and also a complete time reversal symmetry, just like our electric field problem. The maximum symmetric state can be defined on this manifold, and it usually goes by the name of Bunch-Davies because Chernikov-Tagarov did it first. But so it's all the Bunch-Davies. So you can introduce various kinds of coordinates again. You can introduce coordinates that slice through the hyperboloid this way and move up, and these are free spheres as they intersect the hyperboloid. And so you can write the metric in this form with spatial sections that are closed free spheres. Of course, it is both contracting and then expanding, and so the time dependence you have to expect is going to create particles. You can also write it in a different way, completely different way, in terms of static coordinates, in which the metric is just spherically symmetric, but this time, which is not the Robertson-Walker time, doesn't appear in the metric. In other words, it corresponds to a Killing symmetry. And this is similar to the static gauge of the constant electric field, because what happens here is, as in the electric field case, you say, okay, I have a static coordinate chart, so let me introduce the Hamiltonian corresponding to time evolution in that direction. And the problem, again, is that I cannot have Hamiltonian bounded from below, because if I look on the whole De Sitter space, this time translational Killing vector is actually a Lorentz boots. So it has both positive and negative components, and that shows up in the fact that the time direction reverses sign if I go from one side of the De Sitter manifold to the other. So the Hamiltonian is unbounded from below, just like the electric field.
If you thought the Hamiltonian on the whole space made any sense.
Right. Yeah. Which it doesn't.
Correct.
Okay. that is just like the electric. So let's do the coordinates that most people would like to use in cosmology, which is the Robertson-Walker flat coordinates. You can do it in anything you like. Of course, now you only cover half the manifold, namely one of these triangular wedges, and everything is expanding in this manifold. There's another side in this coordinate chart. There's another side where it's contracting, but let's look at it in this half, because that's what most people would like to do in cosmology. Okay, well, we can set up the same canonical formalism again. We can look at the massive wave equation. Fourier transform in the spatial coordinates, e to the I kx, and look at the functions of time that I get. And again, it's a time-dependent oscillator frequency, which now looks like this, where gamma is this ratio of the mass to the Hubble parameter, or the De Sitter curvature. And I've chosen C equals 1/6 for the experts here, but it doesn't really matter. You can do it for any coupling to the curvature. And now you can, again, introduce the adiabatic phase. And you see, at early times, the solutions of this equation are Bessel functions. And the solution, which is a positive frequency solution at early times, corresponds to this Bessel function. However, at late times, if you look at the adiabatic phase, then so this is the early time mode function. I'm sorry, I said it backwards, I think. The early time mode function is a Hankel function, which is a combination of Bessels, and the late time is just a pure J. So again, you have non-trivial scattering, as you would expect in a time-dependent potential, and you can calculate the mixing Vogelbach coefficient, again, just from the formulas for Bessel functions. And it's given, again, by something that's very simple in terms only of this mass parameter gamma. So particle creation occurs. The initial state in this language is Bunch-Davies, but the final vacuum state defined by this mode function is not Bunch-Davies. So the vacuum is basically changing with time, and the state that you started with, which you call the vacuum at initial time, is not a vacuum at late time, it's got particles. And you can understand what's going on again in real time by looking at the adiabatic phase in the complex plane. And when you cross this Stokes line at a particular time, that's when the particle creation event happens. And it's nothing more than the Bessel function changing from its short time to its late time behavior. And you can again introduce a time-dependent particle number. Depending on which approximation you use, you'll get different values in intermediate times. But they all start from zero. They do something around this time of event creation, which is determined by looking at the adiabatic phase. And then they all asymptote to the same Vogelbach value at late times, which is this. Okay? So it's very similar to the electric field problem. And we calculated the decay rate this way. But we also, to be absolutely sure we knew what we were doing, we also did both the electric field and the De Sitter case by artificially turning the field on and off. Okay, so then I start in the flat space at initial time, and I end in flat space at final time. I have no doubt what I'm doing. The vacuum is what it is in each case. And so we took some set of smooth functions which turn on the De Sitter and turn off for some time, and then evaluate how many particles are created at the late time. Okay? So no matter how you do it, you get the same result, basically, that you get a bunch of particles, Vogelbach transformation, which are created. This is now looking at late times in the asymptotic flat region. You get these particles, which are created as a function of k in the De Sitter phase. But then there's a tail, depending on how you turn the thing off at late times. And that's also telling, we puzzled about this for a while, because if you look at the electric field case, there is no such tail. Basically, if I take the time longer and longer, if I take this duration time longer and longer, and I divide it out, I get a clean answer. It goes right to the Schwinger value. But in the De Sitter case, there's a sensitivity to how I turn it off, which maybe you shouldn't be too surprised, because after all, what I'm doing with a profile like this is I'm turning the curvature off everywhere in space, even outside the horizon. It's a kind of funny, unphysical thing to do, but the natural thing to do in the Robison-Walker coordinates. So you get this sensitivity to what's going on basically outside the horizon, and you don't get exactly the De Sitter rate because you have this tail, which is, this is the De Sitter region, and this is something that depends on how I turn it off. Anyway, by any of those methods, question?
Just go back a little bit. So at what point did you deviate from the standard vacuum? Because you said at early times it was the standard vacuum.
You mean in this switching, or you mean in the original?
Earlier. Yeah,
no, we didn't deviate at all. We this initial state, this mode function,
yeah,
that is Bunch Davies in these coordinates.
Right. So why did it ever deviate from Bunch Davies?
Well, the state is always the same, but it's now compared to a different out vacuum.
Oh, I see.
Okay, that's just like the electric field.
Yeah,
so if you think in the Heisenberg picture, the state is not changing, but the field operator is changing, and so it's in a different basis.
Okay, so given a wave number, how do you figure out the out vacuum? What's the basis for choosing this out vacuum?
It's the I epsilon prescription again. It's that if you look at the scattering problem, you see at late times, this goes to a definite phase, you know, the time dependence turns off. Okay, so it becomes a clean out state, and you can just look at what the mode functions are in the out state.
Assuming M squared is bigger than H squared before?
Yeah, I took a massive field. Okay.
So that helps. But if I took a massless, what would it be?
If I took a massless field, I have to rethink this because I can't do, and we were thinking about doing this numerically, because then I don't really have an adiabatic state. What's happening is that I'm going no longer tunneling, it's no longer over the barrier scattering, I'm going through the barrier. And now I have exponential growing modes and damp modes. I have to do that. I didn't do that problem. We were going to follow up, we didn't have it done. Yeah.
Because space-time, the vacuum is not unique.
Of course, that's what I'm telling you.
Why not?
I'm telling you that in order to do this in-out problem, you specify the vacuum by its behavior of these mode functions as t goes to minus infinity, that's in. As t goes to plus infinity, that's out. And by the way, there's no difference between curved space and the electric field problem. The vacuum is undetermined in the electric field problem as well. So I have the only way to determine what state to be in is by this I epsilon prescription. Now you can take any other state and do real-time evolution, do whatever you want, but in order to define this k rate, I'm just following the same pattern that I did in the electric field case, and which gives the Schwinger answer. So the Schwinger answer is easy to get by multiple different means, and the De Sitter case is trickier only because it depends on how you, it seems like it depends how you turn things off. How do you extract the volume factor from the Poglyubov formula? It's a little bit trickier.
Is it
Hamilton? Yeah.
I was in another meeting, but neither your in vacuum nor your out vacuum is the Bunch Davies.
The in vacuum in the Robertson-Walker coordinates is the Bunch Davies.
But then why is the out one not the Bunch? I think maybe that's
This is, the in vacuum is.
Yeah, I mean, just by time reversal or something.
I definitely don't have time reversal. I have an expanding coordinates, and I have an I epsilon prescription.
You have the whole global decision?
No, not in this case.
Oh.
I have the global De Sitter too, but I won't. I don't want to spend all the time on that. We did both. Yeah. We did almost all cases. I mean, what breaks the time reversal is the I epsilon. Is the statement that positive frequencies, that when I decompose a field, any field in Fourier modes, that the mode functions here should be positive frequency in the sense that they are evolving, the phase is evolving forward in time. Okay, that's the Parker definition, adiabatic regularization.
But also you needed to only have half this, otherwise.
No, I didn't need that.
No, because the early time is different geometrically from late time.
But I don't need that. I mean, if I do, I can...
No, I know you say you don't need it, but then probably your early time wouldn't be bunch.
No, then the early time won't be... Then neither the in or the out will be bunch Davis. Yeah, I mean, I could go through that, but, in interest of time, I won't do it. I mean, what happens is the bunch Davis is halfway in between.
Yes.
It's a time, and instead of one creation event, as I have here, you'll get two creation events. You'll get an event in the contracting part, and you'll get an event in the expanding part, but you still get a particle creation, net particle creation, because the in and the out are not the same.
Regarding IOTA, this is why we use Feynman properties.
Absolutely.
It comes from that.
Yeah, I mean, Feynman, understood this.
Yes.
Tringer understood it his way from the heat kernel method. Feynman understood it his way, particles going back in time, but antiparticles, but the ultimate realization, I think, goes back to Stuckelberg, who understood what was going on. Okay. Any other questions? I don't have to get through all this. If I don't make it, I don't make it. but it's trying to go slowly and pedagogic.
What about that tail that you talked about?
Yeah.
Is it, how big is it relative to the weapons?
It depends. It's an interesting thing. We puzzled over it for a while. And first we thought we had numerical problems, but we don't. It was carefully checked. So basically, it depends on this parameter B, which is arbitrary. And so I want to turn on the sitter and then turn it off again. I want to keep it on for a long enough time, but I don't want the edge effects, because obviously turning the field on and off is going to create particles itself. So I don't want this time scale to be short. On the other hand, if I make it longer, then I spend a longer time going out of the sitter. And then all those modes which are going through their creation events as particles, as the sitter is turning off, that's what's responsible for this tail. So this tail is dependent on this parameter B. We played around with B, but we can't get rid of the tail. Either we make the time short, and then you get a burst of particle creation at the end, or you make the time long, and then you get a long tail. So it's telling you there is a difference between the sitter and electric field, and it has to do with causality. It has to do with the fact that the modes outside of the horizon are sensitive to how I turn things off.
And so there's some minimum difference that you can.
Yeah, we chose some compromise before, but it's arbitrary, because what it's telling you is that you don't get, by breaking the sitter invariance in this way, you don't get a unique decision invariant answer. You get something that depends on how I do it.
But can you compare, the total energy or total...
Yeah. That's what this is. This plateau, remember the particle created, the Bogdanov was independent of K, it's dependent only on gamma, mass. So that's what this plateau is. So for a whole range of K, you get the decider values, but then you get the higher K modes tailing off. This is a log plot. So it's tailing off, really quite slowly. And then we looked at the the total number of particles. I have numerical plots. But the point is that the total number of particles, the total mass energy created, also are integrals of this curve. And they'll depend on exactly how you do it. Okay? Yes. So this is, some gritty details. But one thing you can be sure, if you turn it on and off, is that whatever you've got left, those are real particles. I mean, those are the ones that everybody would agree in flat space are particle modes. So one thing I have to tell you, Paul Anderson is very, comes from the QFT and curve space background. And he was very suspicious of that, because it's all this long literature about particles being ill-defined and so on. And he was finally convinced, because that this time-dependent particle number, which then goes to this flat value, really is the one that you see in the final state for the modes that went through their particle creation in the de Sitter phase. So these are, you know, real particles. There's no reason to be too suspicious of them any more than you would be in electric field backgrounds. And of course, there is a necessary uncertainty if you look right in the middle of the time-dependent process. And of course, particle number is not defined because it doesn't commute with the Hamiltonian. All right. So we estimated then each. So notice what happens, though. It's quite amusing. Each k mode redshifts, but more modes undergo particle creation, with the highest k always at the latest time. Right? That's what this that's what this time scale of which when the particle creation takes place. It's basically when k over a has a fixed value. So you go for longer and longer times, more and more modes go through their creation event. K gets larger. And so basically k over a is fixed. So you never redshift away. Each mode redshifts away, but the total amount is finite. So the total energy density is independent of the length of time you spent in the de Sitter phase and is positive. You can estimate it from that de Sitter plateau. And so this, and of course it goes like h to the fourth. This cap is a number of order one. This is the Bogoliubov coefficient. And that implies that if I did back reaction, of course here I didn't. I just artificially watched the fields create particles in a fixed background. But if I did back reaction, I would expect this p plus rho to react back on the curvature through Einstein's equations and to change the expansion rate by an amount that you can estimate. It's no better than an order of magnitude estimate. So it's small, it goes like gh squared. So if h squared is small compared to the Planck, it's a small number, but it's non-zero. So it tells you that the Sitter space cannot be forever. Okay? You have to really think about how this particle creation process is taking place. And nobody has really done a careful back reaction of this case, even in this case. So this is the status. So it's very similar, notice, to the electric field case. And there's a famous minus sign, you know, Lenz law, is that the current is going opposite to the electric field. And Einstein's equations do the same thing. The p plus rho, if any p plus rho positive, is going to tend to decrease h. And the main conclusion here, and so I'm basically get through part one in 1 hour, that's fine. Maximally symmetric state is unstable to spontaneous real particle creation in just the same way the electric field is. The vacuum must be defined in real time, not by Euclidean continuation. If there are any who want to discuss this, we can. But this is, of course, still a very simple-minded Floyd problem, because everything we know from the electric field case, more complicated dynamics, is that you're not going to get a full relaxation, anything like it, until these particles are allowed to interact and induce something like a cascade. And particularly, as they get on the horizon scale, they're going to be long wavelength fluctuations and interactions. So back reaction and interactions are necessary, and you must do that in order to understand where all this is going to go. You can't find it out by looking at free fields and fixed backgrounds. So that's the summary of this. Have any questions? The adiabatic particles are robust. They remain. They're verified by turning off the sitter. But there is this interesting infrared sensitivity. And so I would claim, as I mentioned before you came in, that you might remember that I wrote a paper on this as a postdoc in Santa Barbara. So that's what I was saying then. And I would say it's still true. I mean, you know, after you keep looking at all these different ways of looking at it, you find, again, different ways of seeing the relaxation mechanism. So the part two that I wanted to talk about is how do we describe this in some effective field theory? But you guys should tell me. Should I stop here? It's now 5:30 almost. But let's go back on. I mean, I could have just talked about this. it's sort of a standalone talk by itself. But you know, you're going to ask other questions.
What is in the second part?
Well,
the effective field theory.
What's in the effective field theory? Yeah. I want to. What? You want the slide?
Summary.
I can.
What's the bottom line?
Yeah.
This is the bottom line of this.
What?
Part two.
Sorry.
Yeah. So if you just
you want to go all the way to part two?
Yeah.
The end. By the way, yeah, this came up, so let me show you. This is what in the full hyperboloid. This is what the Bunch-Davies state looks like. So basically, it corresponds to putting in particles in the initial state. They destroy themselves. They stay destroyed for a while, and then they recreate. And so mode by mode, you're creating and destroying particles in just such a way that the pressure and density remain constant. And nothing seems to be happening. But it's quite misleading. And that, of course, would have no decay rate. Yeah.
What's the time scale of the relaxation?
Well, that's what I estimated, and it's only an estimate. The estimate is
compared to the
H. Well, this is very. If this is, if you have a small H compared to a Planck scale, it's a very small effect. It gets important as you go to inflationary models, as you get closer to the Planck scale. But I want to emphasize that this is the minimal thing. I mean, what we did was take. The most clean vacuum state you could take at initial time. There's nothing there, and everything has to be created by, spontaneously. So it's like looking at the Schwinger case, and saying, well, it's exponentially suppressed, so I'll never get anything. The point is, as soon as I put one charge in, it's going to get accelerated, produce an induced cascade. So. In order to really understand what's happening, you should not look at just the spontaneous. You should look at the induced cascade and the interactions, I think. Okay, and that's what I'm partly going to try to address. But this is like scrubbing the problem as clean as you can, just to see, can I keep the vacuum? And I would say for a massive field, and there are a lot of discussions about light fields, and light fields causing all kinds of infrared effects. But for a massive field, in the vacuum Bunch-Davies state, I still get a creation rate and a decay. It's not relevant as it is for cosmology, I think. But it would be no more relevant than the Schwinger rate would be if I just gave you this exponentially suppressed Schwinger rate and said, I've solved the electric field problem. Of course I haven't, right? Because this is way too small. The rate of creating pairs out of the vacuum for a typical field, right, is many orders of magnitude smaller than anything I could see. So that's why I went through this little song and dance that the spontaneous process is only sort of the first thing, just to see what's really going on in the vacuum. But in order to really understand things, you have to go much farther than that. What? Yes?
The pressure state for the dissipative vacuum is rho equals minus p.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
How does that fit in?
Well, I showed that the Bunch-Davies state, apparently nothing is happening. But that when I, as soon as I create particles, they, of course, don't have rho equals minus p. Right.
Well, your decay was proportional to rho equals p.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, since these are ordinary massive particles, of course, they have a p and rho, which are positive. And so they don't obey that equation of state. The Bunch-Davies state is, I'm claiming, artificial. I think for those of you who know Polyakov's work, he's basically saying the same thing. He has a nice phrase. He says it's on life support, which is basically saying that if you design things, it's a design of state, so to speak. If you design things, slipping this sliding, if you design things to exactly cancel, P is equal to minus rho. But if I touch that state a little bit, if I do anything to it, it's not going to stay there. So that's the relation.
The dark energy survey cosmology, trying to show that rho equals minus P.
Yes. So there's some rho equals minus P component.
It's close to rho.
There is some rho equals minus P in the universe. Yes. That's why we want to get the dark energy. But it's not the whole story, right? If I'm...
Is there a mass threshold in your story, like gamma was m squared, h squared minus 1?
No, that was the same question before, is the electric field. There's no threshold.
Well, no, because it's...
But I can't, but I can't, but I can't, but my formulas don't make much sense. They don't make much sense if gamma becomes imaginary.
Yeah, exactly. So is that
that means I can't do an adiabatic vacuum calculation like this, as I said, because it's not over the barrier, it's going through the barrier.
So what would be the idea like?
So you can estimate things just from the exponential going under the barrier. You use WKB approximation. Or you can just do a numerical thing.
Yeah.
Okay, and you basically expect to get the same, you will get the same effect, but with a different coefficient. But that, as far as I know, to my amazement, no one has ever done that. I mean, it would be very simple to take our code and just put the mass to zero. Forget about adiabatic. Just start with the vacuum. Just, you know, start with this turning it on and off and see what you get. And I'm pretty sure you're going to get something of this order of magnitude, but with a different coefficient. Could be done, but maybe it's interesting, maybe it's not. It's interesting, like for the inflaton, if you have a massless field, but it's not. It's going to be dependent on how you turn the de Sitter phase off, which maybe is also interesting for inflation, because it might mean that, depending on what's happening towards the end of inflation, you're going to get a different effect. Somebody wants to see the last slide.
Okay.
But what's your question?
Does this quantum mechanics relaxation connect to the so-called cosmological constant problem?
Sure.
How?
Because the cosmological constant is not constant.
But the variation is very slow.
In this leading order effect, right.
So the vacuum density has to be less than...
So you're asking me questions which I can't answer because I have to go through all this.
Yeah.
But you want to see the last thing? I'll show you the last thing. I'm not going to hide it from you.
The question on the first part also.
Yes.
You can show the last slide.
Yeah. Okay. So we looked in static coordinates, and then there. Basically, there's much bigger effect if you look at the red shift, the blue shift going on toward the horizon. And this will produce a much larger effect. And that's my conclusion, that lambda is not a constant. And there are even ways that we might be able to test it. But that's another talk. So we have to wait. You have to wait. Yes, Dr.
On the first part, you estimated what rho plus p was for the particles on the plateau.
Right. Yeah.
You have an estimate for rho plus p for the tail. Yeah, you've had this.
It's much less. It's declining down.
So for sure, rho plus p is much smaller.
Yeah, because there are fewer particles.
Okay.
I mean, I can show you all the results. I can't resist this.
Okay.